Welcome to Fat Theory Book Club. As always, my name's Amanda Levitt. I'm a PhD candidate from the Department of Sociology at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. I haven't done that in a few episodes, so I thought I'd remind everyone who I am. And with me is Diana E. Anderson, the author of the book In Transit, Being Non-Binary in a World of Dichotomies. Diana, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was very excited because I was, doing this podcast, thinking about doing this podcast, and then you posted about this book coming out, mm-hmm. and you immediately were like, I talk about fat things. And so you really wanted, you're like, Amanda, get me on your podcast, which is always good. I, really envision this podcast just to be a way to have conversations with people about their books or a book, or things mm-hmm. that, interest them. It was really just give me a reason to read things that I hadn't, had time to read. And so I was very excited to be here. And I do have to say, we were talking a little bit beforehand, which happens every single episode. I really think that one thing that is great is that you put a glossary of terms in the very beginning. I wish more books that are very heavy and also, which I wouldn't necessarily say mm-hmm. that this is like super heavy. It's, you are talking about theory, but it's not bogged down in it. It is really what, I would consider to be like an autoethnography, which is, I think, you started writing this around the same time that I was thinking about writing an autoethnography. And so it's kind of great to kind of see how you have pulled this all together. Mm-hmm. but also a really good job of just like going over like gender theory in a way that feels very accessible. Which is always a lovely, lovely thing to see.
Yeah. Many of the reviews of the book have commented about how successfully I made gender theory understandable to them. And stuff. I think it was Library Journal that said that I successfully explained Baudrillard, or however you pronounce his name. And I was very excited with that, because that was the part I was most nervous about, was making sure that it made sense to people who sort of knew the concepts, but didn't understand that language or were brand new to it. So,
yeah. And I think too, I mean, one thing, I mentioned to you prior to starting to record that a lot of faculty in my own department mm-hmm. would be like, ugh, what are, and would want to like tweak these things. But I also think, once you get into grad school, I mean, as mm-hmm. you've seen as well, is that often the way people talk about gender or what they focus on about gender is very specific based on discipline, And so mm-hmm. because sociology is so concerned about institutions, we really think about gendered institutions and what that means, versus, Butler as a philosopher talking about mm-hmm. the very concept of gender as a, as a thing and how it exists and, not even necessarily asking why it exists, because I don't necessarily know if there is a why does it exist?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really interesting to kind of, I really liked being able to come to this and see a really new perspective, but also one that kind of pulls in the things that I think about in my brain about gender all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of my goals in writing, because I also come from academics. And stuff. I did a master's at Baylor University and then followed it up with the master's in women's studies at Oxford. And one of the things that has always been my goal has been to make it translatable and understandable. If you can't, like, with the exception of some like obscure scientific fields and stuff, like in the humanities, you should be able to explain why you study the things you do to a layperson and have it be understandable. And stuff like that is just a principle I try to follow. And stuff. And so that is why, like with publishing, I've always gone with trade publishers and stuff, because I don't want to get bogged down in the academic publishing, which often requires obfuscation in the language for no real reason. I had conversations with grad school, with my advisors in grad school about that kind of stuff, because they'd be like, why'd you choose this simple phrasing when you could have done something more complicated? And I was like, because the simple is easier to understand for like my mom who would read it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example of this, just for people that are listening that are non-academics, mm-hmm. when I was doing my master's thesis, I was looking at trolling online, and mm-hmm. I kept talking about mainstream discourse. Whereas the effect from my committee said, why are you using the word mainstream and not like dominant, you know? Mm. And so it's like that. It's like, because these mean the same thing. Like, let's, yeah. let's be yep. honest. Like, I get, you know, that dominant, you know, is or normative is more of a,
yes.
you know, an academic terminology, but it doesn't necessarily, leads to making it so that they're accessible for people that, you know, mm-hmm. that these things can be life-changing for.
Yeah.
You know, I really appreciated that you made a point to talk about how inaccessible Judith Butler can be. Mm-hmm. And that's just personally because I have a grudge against Judith Butler, because when I first read her, in undergrad, I was taking a women's studies course, because I did undergraduate co-majors in sociology and women's studies. And we had to, this one class, we had to take an assigned reading and then explain it to the class. And I chose a Butler article. And, you know, I ended up, because this is normally what happens when I'm really stressed out, which like, this is like PTSD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't happen as much anymore, but I basically was just like sitting at home crying, not understanding any of it. And so, you know, someone who's my really good friend now, Kelly, she was in that class with me, and I went to class, and we were sitting in the hallway beforehand because there's another class in there. And I just was like freaking out because I had to do this presentation and I didn't know how to explain it. And she literally went like line by line with me and explained what she was saying. And like, you know, after that, because my professor was like, look, like Judith Butler has gotten awards for being the worst academic writer ever. And like her response to it was, you know, that I am not talking about something that is common sense, so you can't expect me to be able to use language that is easy to understand. Mm-hmm. Which, like, on one hand, sure, Judith Butler, you can do whatever you want. On the other hand, she had a sentence that had 14 commas in it, and I am still mad yes. about it to this day. Like,
yes. Yeah. Butler's writing is, it is the worst of that academic, like, the ideas are really, really good and really, really important. But in 1990, when she published Gender Trouble, it was not supposed to be like a public, like for the lay person sort of thing. And it still mm-hmm. really doesn't read that way. Butler's other work is much more accessible, especially the stuff that they've published in like the last few years.
Yeah.
And stuff, the book on force and violence is like that. But and they have acknowledged that during that time that was just how academics wrote as well. Like, it was just, that was the language. And I think there's been, especially in gender and queer studies and trans studies, there's been a movement away from that, because
yeah,
it's a field where the language that we use is deeply important in terms of its accessibility, everything. And
yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, Judith Lorber is probably the sociologist that you know people would point to as the like leader sociologist, like gender mm-hmm. person. I mean, they use the term transsexual in their articles. I mean, that was something that, you know, I mean, I've had friends who have followed in, you know, taking gender mm-hmm. classes and got to Judith Lorber and like had a really hard time reading it because of the language that they were using, but it wasn't that it was hard to read. Like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
you know, it was more of that language is very stigmatizing and very hard to mm-hmm. swallow because time didn't do it service. Yes. And again, it's not to shit on Judith Butler. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. I just think it's also, it depends on what type of academic discipline you're looking at. And, mm-hmm. you know, I am very much not a philosopher. I also, mm-hmm. you know, I took one English class in undergrad and immediately dropped because I just couldn't deal with it. Yeah. Because they wanted to talk about, you know, what the writer meant or like what, I don't remember what book we were reading, but they wanted to talk about like why this wall, like what it meant. And I'm like, it's a fucking wall. Like what? Like, I'm just not, you know, slowly been understanding that I'm, you know, I'm like a little on the spectrum. So I think it might be partly that, but it's, you know, mm-hmm. I think reading is such an interesting way to kind of work through yourself and understand the self. And I am really appreciative of this. And I have a passage that I want to read because for anyone that has the book, it's on page 88. Because I really liked this. You're kind of talking about this idea of home and like where non-binary exists. And so because this book is about non-binary, I thought that this would be a good thing to start with. So non-binary finds a home in the borderlands, neither man nor woman, happily read as the Mindy St. Clair of the gendered world, alone in her own medium place. Transgender, therefore, is both home and not home for those whom the traditional narrative of being trapped in the wrong body, passing and erasing the history of one's own body, going deep stealth, is a home for them. It is a final resting place, a culmination of years of work into becoming. For non-binary, it is our desire to simply exist as a not, as a permanently perceived other. Our very presence calls to attention the question of gender as a given, forcing others into confusion to the delight of our trollish selves. Non-binary people are, in a sense, fleeing womanhood and manhood, but we are not fleeing to a perceived easier space or to a home necessarily. We are fleeing to the in-between, constantly running, forever traveling, but never landing in that liminal space between destinations. I am choosing for now to exist in this middle ground, in my middle place. I thought that was really beautiful.
Thank you.
So if you were to decorate your middle place, what would it look like?
The metaphor that I like to use for my gender, and it's similar, the discussion extended out of a discussion I had with Casey Slack, who is a Unitarian reverend. They just moved to Washington, D.C., and they are also a fat liberation person. And they describe their gender as sort of a transatlantic flight, where you're constantly in the air. And that metaphor is very perfect. And the more I've thought about it, for me, it's more of you're on a train. And so the scenery is constantly changing, but it's a smooth little ride and you can get up and walk around. You're not trapped in your seat like you are on an airplane. And for me, that sort of metaphor is what works. So like for decorating my my transitory liminal space and stuff, it would just basically be big windows with different images of all the different places that we go through as we travel around, a bit like Snowpiercer but without the like apocalyptic vibes.
So. Yeah, and not eating people because
or cockroaches or bugs or
yes, eating people, those are good
protein. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Bugs. Oh, yes. They're not eating people. They're eating bugs. That was Soylent Green. that was a different thing that I was pulling from. Yeah. I think that I mean, it's so interesting for me because I feel like I had, while reading this book, I definitely had, you know, kind of a similar experience going into the academy and reading theory and seeing different perspectives about, you know, feminist perspectives, particularly about gender. And, you know, what I really came out of from that was that there was a lot of femme phobia that was very much attached to that space that, you know, and even, I mean, and, you know, feel free to jump into, but mm-hmm. I think a lot about the ways that even in the space where we are, you know, quote unquote, not performing gender properly, mm-hmm. because as you talked about in the book about compulsive heterosexuality, that there yes. is this assumption that if you are a woman, that you have to be in a relationship with a man, a cis man, mm-hmm. cis woman. But then at the same time, if you are not part of that compulsive heterosexuality, then you should also be moving away from femininity in some way.
Yes.
But we don't consider that something that people who are masculine, we don't consider it to be the same thing. Like, we don't hate mm-hmm. on the masculinity. I mean, obviously we hate mm-hmm. on toxic masculinity, but masculinity is really still treated as the norm. And yes. that to me was like really hard and frustrating and became mm-hmm. a very contentious place for me to like sit in for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, and yes.
Yeah. There's femphobia is a really good term for it. And it's a lot of it at its root is just plain old misogyny, and mm-hmm. particularly for assigned male at birth people, it's trans misogyny in a lot of ways. But it's also this idea that if you are a woman who is feminist, and I don't want to use it as a pejorative here, but woke, that sort of idea, you are eschewing anything that could be seen as feminine. Mm-hmm. Part of the presentation of the feminist, and this is partly like the negative stereotype that's been put upon us, but also something that I have found in feminist circles leans that way, where the hyper-feminine is seen as giving in to the patriarchy in some way, mm-hmm. or it is catering toward the male gaze, even if it's appearing with a lesbian, you know, on yeah. like it's a lesbian doing it. And there's this way of disparaging that which is stereotypically feminine as something that comes from outside of the woman themselves, mm-hmm. rather than something that the woman themselves could be engaging with and having fun with and enjoying as part of their own expression of their womanhood. And there's not a really there's discussions that happen about this, but like in mainstream discourse, it's not a thing that gets talked about a lot, where like feminist spaces are very negative toward femme performing women.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just remember, I mean, you know, this is the same class that I cried over Butler, but like, I just remember like at the end, a lot of the, and this is an undergraduate class, but a lot of my classmates were like really struggling with like, so are we just supposed to hate femininity? Like they, you know, like they just are like mm-hmm. leaving this classroom thinking that. And, you know, it's for me, I mean, I identify as femme. I, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like it is a, for many people, it can be, femme can be non-binary. I think mm-hmm. that the kind of in between is just, I like that idea of it, because it really is just an acknowledgement of that the other, mm-hmm. that you are not performing femininity, or, you know, hegemonic, you're not performing hegemonic femininity, you're not performing hegemonic masculinity, which like mm-hmm. most people aren't, like, you know, which is something that when I teach about gender, I always really like asking my students to tell me about a time where they were told that they weren't performing gender properly. And like all of them can. Though I will say that the boys or men in my classroom are very quiet, because there is something about, because this is not just even a question of, if you're not performing masculinity because of compulsive heterosexuality, if you're not performing it properly, then that is also bringing into question your sexuality or everything. Mm-hmm. But it is always really illuminating how people are able to really point to those very early instances. Like in the book, you talk mm-hmm. about, you know, having you go to church and you had a dress mm-hmm. and new shoes on, and you got those, you fucked up those shoes climbing a tree.
Yes.
but it's, you know, it is always really illuminating, because I think most people, even if they hate trans folks, if they're transphobes mm-hmm. and TERFs and whatever else, like most of them aren't performing gender, you know, in a way that is that they're supposed to, like, supposed to, in quotes, I should say.
Yes. Yeah. Jules Gills Peterson, who is a fantastic academic at Johns Hopkins, and she wrote Histories of the Transgender Child. She has talked about how cisgender as a term is kind of nonsense, because it assumes that there are people who are able to perform whatever this gender thing is mm-hmm. perfectly. And so in a sense, like, it works as a label in that it helps us define, like, the marginalized group by naming the quote unquote norm. But on an individual level, it doesn't function that way all that well, because it's sort of like the, well, everyone's a little bit queer probably, and so everyone's a little bit trans sort of idea. Mm-hmm. But, and so the utility of those ideas, because everybody transgresses gender in their own way. And so it's not really a cogent term that works on an individual level. It's much more of a systematic or a systemic description than anything else.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about when I wanted to have you on was, well, I feel like every other day you're either fighting with Mormons or TERFs on Twitter. Like, this is why we're friends. You know, I love seeing that you had Casey and, you know, and name dropped them in the book, because Casey, mm-hmm. you know, organized with me with Abundant Bodies for mm-hmm. a year. And, you know, and so we definitely run in the same circles. We run in like a Twitter circle of folks.
Yes.
Which is like, I'm love that you're writing about fat stuff, because I think so many people, if you're in fat liberation spaces, particularly, want to talk about gender in some very mm-hmm. specific ways. I mean, femme identity is, fat femmes particularly is mm-hmm. a very big, big thing. And I think for people who are non-binary and aren't interested in femininity and feminine practices are, you know, in many cases, if we were talking 30 years ago, they would be considered butch because we didn't have mm-hmm. those words, you know, even androgynous often I have never Googled the word androgyny, but if you look at all the photos, it's like pretty much like kind of a masculine looking person mm-hmm. that doesn't have, you know, is very, very thin, mm-hmm. you know, but still is not, you know, it still feels like the perception of what womanhood is very, it's not that, you know?
Yep.
But I really appreciate, like, I think there was and for anyone that doesn't know, TERF stands for trans, exclusionary radical feminists. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I always think is really fascinating, some of the most famous, which I'm not going to name any of them because they don't mm-hmm. deserve to have their names listed, but some of the most well-known TERFs that have done so much horrifically terrible shit are often like breaking gender norms.
Yes.
Every day. Like there was a someone, and maybe you posted the video of it, but there was a TERF that was at a public school meeting or something, and mm-hmm. they had like they side cut with like, I mean, not
yeah.
totally similar to your mm-hmm. haircut, but kind of similar to your haircut.
Yeah, sort of the undercut.
Yes.
More hair on top.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's so
that is like the unofficial non-binary haircut.
It is. I mean, I used to have, I'm currently like, I if I put my hair up, I look like a little like 1800s like little boy because I'm mm-hmm. growing out my undercut right yeah. now. But yeah, it's so interesting that so many of the people that are so fervently full of hatred about transness mm-hmm. are themselves breaking gender norms
yeah.
in a way that is like, for me, I'm like, this is fascinating, but also like, you all are really fucked up, but fascinating. Because mm-hmm. I can't remember
yeah.
the last time I've seen, I mean, and I don't, you know, I don't stare mm-hmm. at TERFs. I generally avoid them yep. and wander off, but like, you know, I never went to like the women's festival that used to be on the west side of the state, the Michigan Women's Festival, that
Lilith Fair or whatever it was.
No, there was something called the Michigan.
Yes. So Michigan Lilith... Women's Fest.
Yes. Yeah. So Lilith Fair was with Sarah McLachlan. I know that.
Ah, yes.
I know that because I wanted to go and my mom got tickets and then she didn't take me and I'm still mad about it. So the Michigan Women's Festival, I mean, I'm sure yes. that the TERFs that were involved in that were, you know, were not necessarily breaking those gender binaries, but, you know, it's really mm-hmm. interesting to me how so many people that are having discussions about gender and the fear over, you know, queer folks, trans folks, grooming children are coming from people that are like breaking them themselves, you know?
Yeah. It's these are people who, if they had their way, they would get yelled at in the bathroom for being out of place. Mm-hmm. That is sort of their image. And there's a lot of probable psychology that goes on there where they are blaming their own problems with their womanhood on trans people in order mm-hmm. to like sort of outsource it and make it into like this systemic problem rather than they're just not willing to look at their own gender, which is one of the reasons my first advice to any cis person who wants to be a trans ally is examine your own gender, think about why you are what you are, what it means to be what you are, and see if you can come up with a definition that's cogent for you. And you may discover some things about yourself, but don't be scared of that. And I think there's a lot of fear within TERF circles of that being a woman for them is this definitional thing, and they want to be able to have it all to themselves and be like this mold breaking thing while still maintaining womanhood, and they don't know how to do that without hating on trans people. One of the yeah. reasons I addressed it as like escaping womanhood, because that's something I am assigned female at birth. I have been accused of doing that by coming out as non-binary, that I am running away from the oppression of womanhood. And there's this idea that womanhood is created of oppression. And therefore, why wouldn't you want to escape? J.K. Rowling, oh, I don't want to mention by name, the big famous Harry Potter author.
I'll cut that out.
Yes. Yeah. Famous magical wizarding world author wrote in her big Turf Wars piece that she might have been convinced to be non-binary or a trans man or something in the 80s because she was so upset with her womanhood. And so there's like a weird aspect of jealousy happening there where they're like, this person yeah. escaped. They should have to stay in this cage with me. Mm-hmm. When like as I say in the book, it's not escaping anything because it was never like a home to me to begin with. I can't talk about what it's like to be a woman because I'm not one. And I could never define womanhood for myself because I wasn't one. I didn't know what it felt like to be a woman because I didn't feel like one. It wasn't something that ever made sense to me as a category into which I fit. Even though I tried a lot. And there's this, there's also historically a lot of political lesbianism in that, that went into like the complete rejection of men. But it's also currently the current TERF lesbian movement where it's like, lesbians are only interested in cis women. And trans men are not, like, you are just wayward lesbians and stuff. Like, those lines of gender have always been kind of wishy-washy in the lesbian community. It's not, they've never had, like, a really hard line of that, even for the hard stone butches who could pass for men and stuff were still considered part of the lesbian community. And it's weird to see them turning that on its head and rejecting trans men, or like just seeing them as misled wayward women who, why can't they just be butch? And it's like, well, there are people who are butch lesbians who are like that, but there are also trans men who are like that. And so that's always been a historic thing of lesbians sort of existing as this third space. And it's a weird misunderstanding of what queerness looks like, particularly for both AMAB and AFAB people.
Yeah, and the, you know, this idea that non-binary people or trans folks in general are escaping their, you know, the sex they're assigned at birth, or, you know, for people who are assigned female at birth, escaping women's oppression. I mean, you're escaping to be treated like shit somewhere else. Like, it's not, you're not like getting a step up on things. I mean, it's, you know, I had a really good discussion. I had, I taught in a high school for the first time ever. It's the first time I'd ever been to a high school since I was in high school. Oh, so man. That was like a lot, but I was teaching a dual enrolled class. And I had some really adorable lesbian students that were they were great. They dressed like they were from the 90s, which also just made me really enjoy them because, like, you know, like one of them kept coming in with like Fila shirts and stuff on. And I was like, oh my God, amazing. I love this. But we had a really good discussion because, like, one of them was more mask presenting, which it's interesting because people say mask instead of butch, which is like, again, this is just different language. Identity is, like, I think for me, the idea of this, the in-between is being comfortable with letting individuals decide what words they want to define for themselves. But they had a question. We were talking about gender, and they said that, because so many questions about gender and sex and sexuality is really hard for undergraduates, let alone people that are in high school. So I let them submit anonymous questions to me, which one of the guy students asked what a fallopian tubes were, because I mentioned it the class beforehand. And like, you know, I'm really obnoxious. I'm like, the fallopian tubes are where the egg goes down and the egg goes wee, and like, you know, because, you know, why not?
Perfect.
But this, you know, one student was asked about, like, it seems like masculinity is, you know, as a lesbian, masculinity is demonized. And I had to be like, okay, so I think that, yes, as a person who was assigned female at birth, going towards and in feeling a connection with masculinity can definitely feel and be stigmatizing. But you can't ignore that femininity, which is linked to the core of womanhood, however you want to describe it, but femininity, feminine practices, feminine, aesthetic, feminine, everything is at the core demonized in a way that masculinity isn't, you know? And we, and it was just like a really, like, it was a really lovely moment because these were just like really great kids that really just wanted to understand and had these really big questions about gender that they've never been able to ask anyone about. Which is like, I always am totally stoked to like, at, you know, have those types of conversations. But it is, I mean, I think that for so many of us, I think that we just push down and push to the side the fact that often a lot of the things that we are taught to feel bad about ourselves is about gender, and it's about the expectations of what our bodies are supposed to look like, the expectations of the roles we are supposed to have in our families and in at work and all of these other things, that it is about gender, and that bringing in, you know, in breaking past those binaries and understanding that gender is a spectrum, you know, and that there's an in-between, or, you know, however you want to, however someone wants to define it, really just opens up possibilities for different ways for people to exist.
Yeah. There's this idea that transness is based on stereotypes. Like I talk in the book about how I was a tomboy growing up. I hated wearing girly clothing, like lace and all that. And I climbed trees, and I wanted to do some boy things, but didn't like get allowed to in some ways, like things like mowing the lawn as a chore. I wanted to learn how to do that, and I was never allowed to. And people will latch onto that and be like, well, that's just a stereotype about womanhood. Like the fact that you don't think that women can do those things means you're engaging in stereotypes, and you had to be something other than a woman in order to do them. And like, that's not it. The fact is that those cultural signifiers and symbols are things that are language that we have to describe our relationship to gender. They're always going to be a little bit removed from whatever this gender thing actually is. They're always going to be stand-ins for how we talk about these amorphous concepts of masculinity and femininity. And so like my ways of expressing my gender dysphoria, which I've realized in my 30s was like, all this gender dysphoria and anxiety caused by gender dysphoria, was to both like at times lean hard into femme. I did that a few times of like, there were periods in my life where I was like, okay, I am going to be a proper woman and wear skirts and like do makeup and all that. And it never quite worked for me, or like just lean hard into being butch. And those were the, I look back now, and that was dysphoric me trying to figure out what fit for me and how to feel comfortable about my presentation in the world. And when I realized that, oh, I'm not any of those things. I'm not a woman. I'm not a man. I'm this thing that's in between. And I want to like be an agent of chaos and have people look at me and go, what is that? And stuff like, once I found that, I was like, oh, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. But like all those instances, that's just how I just try to make myself comprehensible to cis people. Because it's trying to explain this inner lived experience to somebody who does not have that experience. And that's always very, very hard.
It's also just... because you talk about in the book about the lawn mowing thing. Like, I also had this experience. Like, I wanted to ride the lawnmower. We had a riding lawnmower. I thought it looked fucking fun as shit.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ride a lawnmower. But the fact that people are like projecting that is, oh, but that's a gender stereotype. Yeah, but that's not a gender stereotype that you chose. It's your parents who made you do these very gendered roles. Because my dad, I asked my dad, I'm like, why haven't you ever let me mow the lawn? And he's like, well, you can go do the dishes with your mom, you know, because he just was like, your brother's a boy. He gets to ride the lawnmower.
Yeah.
And like now, like my greatest dream is to have enough property that I have a riding lawnmower. You know, I think that it's so interesting how the critiques of transness and the critiques of non-binary, and obviously you talk about it being you know, the trans umbrella as a I mean, we've talked about this. So when I'm saying transness, I'm meaning like all of that for dear listeners.
Yep.
But that the critiques of transness rely on those like are not even understanding gender enough to actually give a good critique. I mean, you know, I mean, this is, yeah, I mean, hatred is illogical. Like, I think once you're in activist spaces, you know that it's power is just power, and it's Olive, you want to come say hi? Come here, big boy.
Olive,
come here. Good boy.
Minerva.
Didn't hear him. He makes a good.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Olive, I love how he always looks so grumpy.
Yes. Yes. I wanted to bring him on because you've talked about how, you know, as you know, his name's Olive, but he is a boy.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because everyone's like, oh, Olive, it's a girl. And then I'll say, and I'll just use he, and then they'll be like, oh God, I'm so sorry. But then they won't do that for trans people. So
yes. Yeah. I have a friend. Two of my friends just had a baby. They're lesbians married to each other. So one of them actually carried the pregnancy, and they did genetic testing early on and found out that they were having a boy. But they had already decided to call the fetus Cupcake just until he showed up. And one of their moms was really upset that they were still calling him Cupcake because that was a feminine term. And it was one of those things where it's like, you have a lesbian daughter. Like, what are you? it was one of those wild things. And Cupcake isn't all that feminine. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's describing an in utero baby. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think so much of our, you know, not to keep talking about TERFs, but I think just gender anxiety that people have in general is just because, you know, we're taught that it is a static thing, and that, you know, it's biology, and you can't change biology, you know. And like, you know, in your glossary, one of the things that I always really like talking about when I'm teaching about gender and sex is really getting past, because a lot of sociologists really like to say sex is biology, you know, and sure, maybe, but it's just because it's biology doesn't mean it's also not socially constructed in a way that is also about those same institutions and structures that you have. That because, you know, sex leads into gender. I mean, I'm like looking for your glossary to like pull it back up. But yeah, so sex, you say, the physical representation of one's assigned gender appearing biologically in genitals and in secondary sex characteristics such as breasts or facial hair. I think it is a really good definition because we're talking about physical representation of one's assigned gender. And I always think it's really interesting to talk about the reality that sex is a socially constructed process, how we sexed people, how we have created this binary, because, you know, it is a very unscientific process. When a baby's born, you look at their genitals and you throw them into one category or the other, or they're in this in between where doctors will say that they are have ambiguous genitalia.
Yes.
You know, AKA they're intersex. Mm-hmm. But that we don't, you know, we think that that relates to chromosomes. Like one, mm-hmm. yes, in many cases it does, but it doesn't always. There are people that get thrown into either category, get assigned either category, and, you know, don't necessarily have the chromosomes mm-hmm. that link up to them. There are so many other things that are about the body and biology.
Yes.
And we can't just say that, you know, that it is biology, because that's just, mm-hmm. even biologists will tell you that it's not that simple.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the things that really made me smile while I was working on the book and stuff. Like, for some reason, I had to get out my birth certificate for some identification thing. And I saw on there that there's a note where the doctor signs, and it, like, the line is, I testify that this is true to the best of my ability and stuff, and that includes like the information about sex and all that. So mm-hmm. it's literally like in 1986 the standard paperwork was for the doctor to say, this is my best guess as to what mm-hmm. this child is, based on knowledge and my ability, which is very literally the doctor saying, this is an assignment, it may not be true. Like, that's how I read it. And it's that process is really fascinating to me, because it is literally a construction of the doctor looking at it and saying, okay, this looks to fit into that category,
mm-hmm.
Rather than like, oh yes, we have tested their chromosomes and they are this, and like, I don't know what my chromosomes are. I've never had them tested.
Yeah.
They're probably XX, but I don't know. My brother mm-hmm. has Down syndrome. His chromosomes, we know what one of them looks like, but we don't know what the others are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of those things where, like, you are literally just constructed into that. And so for me, I don't really particularly like to make a distinction between sex and gender, mm-hmm. Because it is not something that's all that useful, I think, because of the ways in which we construct sex and the ways in which we conflate sex and gender. Like, there's the entire reason it used to be called transsexualism and sex change operations was because the belief was that when you transitioned, you were changing sex. And mm-hmm. so current conversation has regressed a lot on that, but that is literally what the language is. And on a historical note, as far as like birth and infants, the pronoun that was used up until the 20th century for infants, like kids under one, was it. You would call the child it until it survived infancy, and then it got a gender, basically.
Yeah.
And that is the historical fact of it. We literally decided not to give that child any personhood until we knew it was going to live for a little longer, which is one of those linguistic things that we would look at now and go, ooh, how dare you call that baby it, but yes. It was just normal.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, I think for sociologists, it really is trying to, again, preserve that idea of biology. But then mm-hmm. also, you know, we think of, I think one of my, because I, you know, am a gender scholar, but like one of the professors that's also a gender scholar in my department would say, sex is biology, gender is, you know, how mm-hmm. you feel as an individual, but then also the social structures that are built around those mm-hmm. genders, you know? So it is, it goes from the interpersonal to the institutional to the systemic, yes. you know? And so it really is, it is so complicated. And I think that mm-hmm. for me is why, you know, I'm still in this space where femme identity is kind of where I feel like I ended up. Mm-hmm. But it's also in the same way that you talked about how gay is a political identity. I mean, mm-hmm. I think obviously trans is a political identity. Femme for me is very much a political identity.
Yes.
You know, you have an entire chapter about being fat. And I think fatness, like class and ability or disability, like race and all of these other things are are very at odds with what heteronormative femininity or mm-hmm. heteronormative masculinity would like us to believe, because the, you know, the pinnacles of either of those are someone who is white, middle to upper class, mm-hmm. Thin, able-bodied, mm-hmm. you know, is probably, you know, at an elite institution. I mean, mm-hmm. there are so many other ways that we can think about it. As Christian, obviously, as well, yes. if we're talking about the United States, but I would say everywhere mm-hmm. for the most part. I mean, you know, imperialism and Christianity mm-hmm. tends to run along hand in hand yeah. together. But that, you know, femme identity, when I really found it, it was when I was trying to come to grips with the fact that, you know, I grew up as I was in beauty pageants in a really young mm. age. And so I did have this idea of, okay, so femininity, being a woman, means you have to be pretty. Well, once mm-hmm. I became a teenager and started gaining weight, which was really like, I was like 11 or 12. So like early mm-hmm. teens. But once that happened, it was that I couldn't be a woman because I'm fat, you know? And so it really wasn't until I learned about femme identity in that yeah. same class where everyone hated femininity
yes.
that I was like, this is like, gives me language for something that I didn't know how to have language mm-hmm. for. And I think that is what, you know, as the passage I read, so many of us are trying to find mm-hmm. that home and trying to find a word that describes that thing that we are looking for. And for some people, maybe there isn't a word. Maybe you have to mm-hmm. make it up yourself.
Yeah. It's the ways in which fatness interacts with gender is really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Because fatness very often is degendering. For AMAB people, it is a feminizing thing. And mm-hmm. for AFAB people, it's literally just misogyny tied together with beauty standards or whatever you want to call it, of like, you are undesirable. And so reclaiming sort of a femme identity within that is, I believe, a very feminist act.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like, I mean, whatever gender relationship, whatever relationship you have to your gender doesn't necessarily have to be like this feminist thing, but it is. When we exist in a fatphobic culture, it is that thing. For me, yeah. my relationship to fatness has always been kind of fraught, because I was a skinny, skinny kid until I hit like mid-20s. And then I started gaining weight, which is the same thing that happened to my mom.
Yeah.
So like, I took after her with that. And it wasn't until, like, I struggled with the idea of being fat as a non-binary person. And then I saw this fat man on the bus and I was like, that's the body I want. Like, it was this weird revelation moment of like, I can imagine myself as like a fat guy, a dude-ish sort of person.
Got that dad wearing bod.
Yes. Yeah. And so seeing that form of like masculinity for me was really freeing. To see that within this, with a fat person who was not, would not be like most of culture would reject that. But I looked at that and went, hey, cool. That's what I want to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what I ended up getting. Like, once I had top surgery, I was like, I have the dad bod. Yes.
Yeah.
sort of thing. I'm really happy about it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I even, you know, one of my favorite books is by Peter Henin. It's Fairies, Bears, and Leathermen. Mm. Really, I recommend it just because the title's really good, but it's yes. an ethnography of like gay men. I know that they're at a satellite school at Ohio State. I don't remember specifically where it was, but I think that, you know, fatness is, when we're talking about masculinity specifically, mm-hmm. like fatness is a really interesting place because it is treated as feminized, but at the same time, mm-hmm. like my dad was a fat man. He died mm-hmm. looking like Santa Claus, you know, yeah. his masculinity was really never in question. Like mm-hmm. And I think that it is, it's like a yes. And like, I think mm-hmm. that it is like feminized, but it isn't the same as, you know, the being a woman, I guess I should say, yes, or like femininity, or, yeah, you know, and so I think that there's like levels to it, but mm-hmm, it is really interesting because again, you're not conforming to hegemonic masculinity. And so mm-hmm, that is where people start getting lost in the sauce, I guess, if we want to.
Yes. Yeah. And that's something. The entire reason like dad bod became a thing, because dad bod is still a desirable thing.
Yeah.
And stuff is still masculine. It's just fat. It has a beer gut or whatever. And the ways in which we describe that are fundamentally different from how fat AFAB people are talked about.
Yes.
And fat cis women are discussed. Because fatness there isn't this masculinizing force. It isn't this, it isn't the opposite of what fatness does to masculinity. It is completely degendering. It is the removal of any aspect of what we would traditionally call gender or womanhood or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and I do want to say, because we've used the acronyms a bit, but, you know, going off of the idea that sex is socially constructed. So we're using AMAB, was assigned male at birth. like trying to see it in my head and then say it out loud.
Yep.
For some reason came out weird. But yeah, so assigned male at birth or assigned female at birth. Mm-hmm. Again, to acknowledge that isn't something that is assigned to an individual, mm-hmm, that is not something necessarily that is based in biology, and that we are using all of these different measures to decide what gender, you know, or what sex someone is assigned. Yep.
And ACAB is assigned cop at birth.
Yes. Or all cops are bastards. Either one, you know, if you're assigned cop at birth, I really hope you didn't have a gun in your mom's uterus, because that sounds terrible. But yeah, I think that when we start talking about gender and about non-binary, and we start using all of these other words, it allows for people to really start, again, as you said, thinking about what do these words mean to me. You know, I am a, you know, for anyone that is on my Instagram, I am a very handy person, and I started calling myself a handy femme because I was so annoyed that everyone kept talking about handy butches, you know?
Yeah.
And most of it was because like some of my femme friends, one was Laura Luna P, who is one of the first guests that I had on this. They would always talk about that they needed a handy butch to help them. And I'm like, well, I'm a handy femme and I can tell you what to do, you know, like, but I do. I think that it is really about getting us to break away from our preconceived notions about how biology is somehow linked to the things that we like and the things that we're good at and the ways that we act in the world, and really just creating a world of possibilities where people can like be them fucking self. Like, this is the fact that there's an entire extremist movement about that, it just is fucking wild to me. Like,
it's scary. At the end of the day, I want people like my nieces to grow up in a world where they can be whoever they want to be when they grow up, and that is not just like a career thing under capitalism, but a personhood individual thing where they can be their best and most authentic self, whoever that turns out to be.
Yeah, and that includes things like, you know, as you said, it's not just career, but personhood, deciding whether you want to be married, who you want to be married to, do you want to have children, do you want to give birth yourself if you can, or do you not? Yeah. I personally would love to donate my uterus to a trans person, but that apparently is very, you know, like trans folks have been able to have babies, but like, you know, so there's so many different ways to think about it. And I think we are at this point where, you know, really traditional values are contending with the fact that science is so far ahead of that, and that it allows for people to have, you know, a wide variety of, you know, procedures done on their bodies. You know, you were talking about in the book, obviously talking about like the history of You know, surgeries, top surgery, bottom surgery. And for me, I mean, I just always think about it in the same way that, like, we wouldn't, why are we getting mad at someone who wants to have top or bottom surgery when we're totally okay with people getting breast implants or reductions or getting a vagina lift or some shit, whatever the fuck that that is, you know, or having, you know, so many other ways that we are allowing people to change their bodies and to do it where it feels like it's closer to home. I mean, I'm getting a tattoo right now. And while that is very minimal compared to having top or bottom surgery, that is, yes, you're showing me your tattoo. I'd have to take my pants off to show you mine. So I'm not going to do that. But you know, it's on my hip. It's not anywhere that exciting. It's just hidden. You know this, but for anyone else that doesn't know, you know, but I think that it is, it is, we have so much discomfort over people changing their bodies in these very specific ways because there's so much stigma around transness, but we are okay with it in other ways. Yes. I mean, this to me reminds me of, you know, how much xenophobia there was after 9/11 and people talking about how women wearing hijabs is incredibly oppressive and all of that. And I would be like, but we like expect women to have breast implants and plastic surgery and Botox and all of these other things. I'm like, how can you say one thing is we're okay with it in this way, but you don't like it this way because it's not the norm to you.
Yes. And I will say even closer on the hijab thing, nuns wear habits. Like we have that same sort of conservative dress in Christian traditions.
Yes.
But my thing, comes down to bodily autonomy for all. You should be able to make your body feel comfortable for you and for what it needs to be home for you, because it's the only body you get. It's what you are on this earth. It is you for all intents and purposes. And cis people get gender affirming surgery all the time. Cis women get breast implants or breast reductions because they don't like how people stare at them or whatever because of genetics.
Because their back hurts.
Cis men will get like leg extensions to be taller. Like, we do all these things on demand for cis people. And with trans people, it has to be pathologized and and you have to get letters from a therapist to make sure that you're okay to go through with it, even though like gender affirming surgeries have one of the lowest regret rates in the entire world. And the entire thing is that like you should be able to just do what you want with your body because it's your body.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that's what it is. You should be able to get an abortion or have a baby. Either one, if that's your choice. You should be able to change the size of your chest and stuff and do things that make you feel more at home. So that's ultimately why I ended up getting top surgery. I didn't feel like me with them there. And so this April I went and got it, and I have not ever been happier in my life. I feel like when I look down, it's me. So is that Lulu?
Yes, this is a Lulu.
Hi.
Go on. She's my snuggle baby.
Yes.
I mean, you know, fat community, obviously we have this conversation about bodily autonomy. Often it happens around weight loss. And I think, you know, I will say I think there are caveats, but I don't think the caveats are about what an individual chooses, but how institutions make that choice the only choice that's available. And this happens to trans folks as well. I mean, something that I have definitely had conversations with other with fat trans folks is being able to get hormones, but mm-hmm. depending upon your BMI, or being able to get top or bottom surgery. A lot of doctors won't do it if your BMI is over a certain amount.
Yep.
So there are a lot of people who will end up having gastric bypass surgery first and then having that. And so that is where it isn't really about autonomy. I mean, it can be if, you know, I am past the time where I am mad at people for choosing to have gastric bypass. The thing I am mad about is that that's the only option and that there isn't something else, because, you know, I'm currently working on my dissertation proposal and I've switched my dissertation to looking at medical fat phobia specifically and fat people's experiences with the medical industrial complex. And one of the things that I started doing for the introduction was doing a deep dive on medical treatments for fatness. And all of it is about making fat people thinner. It's not about treating fat people with dignity. It's not about reducing stigma. The American Medical Association, they had an article. This is I'm not going to get too in the weeds about this, but this is where I got real pissed about it was, I'm going to keep ranting about this until I'm done with my dissertation. I know it. This is going to what's happening.
I appreciate it, though. It's fascinating.
But yeah,
And anger-making.
Yes, anger-making, fascinating, all of these things. Hold on one sec. But yeah, so the reason I started looking at it was because I was on the American Medical Association's website. It may have been the Journal for the American Medical Association, which it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. And they had an article about how to make practices more accessible and inviting for fat people. While their first recommendation was to tell fat people that obesity is a disease. So this is like, you know, I mean, this is like expecting gay people to go into the doctor and telling them, well, you know, being gay is, you know, a mental disorder, you know, or you know, all of the other things that you could do, you know, and so it's, you know, when you're not creating a way for someone with a, you know, non-normative body type to be able to seek care, and all you're doing is instead pushing them into having weight loss surgery, that isn't true autonomy, you know? And so that to me is like this very big distinction that I always like to make, because I think that it isn't, that is coercive, you know? And so, you know, at the end of the day, yes, there are many individuals who may choose to do that. And I am very much over like shaming people for that. And that's just because I don't have the mental energy for it. And like people are making a false choice, you know, it's like, that's the only choice that they're given. But you know, it is, we are seeing these like very distinctly different things happening, because, you know, it's a coercive choice for trans folks when they want to have top or bottom surgery. And then they have to choose to have, you know, they have to have gastric bypass surgery if they want to be able to have hormones and everything else. You know, it's a false choice when someone wants to go have knee surgery, but they have to have gastric bypass surgery first, you know, like, so this is where, you know, when we're talking about body autonomy, this is a really good example of what is that? Where is coercion? Where isn't? And, you know, when institutions don't give you another avenue, you know, it's, so that was my mini rant that I'm mad about forever.
No, that is, that was a consideration that was really like anxiety producing heading into consults for top surgery and heading into surgery itself. Because as a fat person, I was like, do they have a BMI limit at this surgeon? Like, are they going to look at me and say, no, you're too heavy, you need to lose weight? And that's something I see replicated online in trans spaces, because I'm part of like surgery support groups and stuff. And there are people who come in and say, my doctor told me I have to lose a certain amount of weight before they'll take me in. And it's really this idea that you have to be specific because medicine doesn't want to adapt to fat people. Because I, being the person I am, read up on why that sort of stuff is, and it's anesthesiology most of the time. Like, they don't want to do the calculations, and it's like, that's just do the math. just do your job.
Yeah, it's because they weren't taught to.
Yes, and that's ridiculous. That is a systemic issue that happens. And yeah, I'm really glad that you're pursuing medical fat phobia, because that is one of my hobby horses.
In
my volunteer work. So
yeah, I mean, part of it is, you know, I've had the same. I'm very lucky in that I have a primary care physician. She's an adorable, like, queer lady. All of her scrubs are purple. It's like, it's great. Like,
yeah.
And she lives in the city I lived in for a while, which is Waterford, Michigan, which is like a very kind of conservative area. So it's like a very interesting thing. But she's been my doctor for like probably 15 years now. And she has, medical students that follow her, you know, and that do rotations with her. And anytime that I'm like on her list, she tells them to go see me and to ask about my research, because she wants them to learn about fat phobia.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it took her forever to be able to just get chairs without arms in her office.
Yep.
But part of the reason why, I mean, part of it is, you know, the transphobia issue that I'm, you know, the participants that I want to pull from for my study are going to be across the spectrum instead of, I mean, obviously, like, most of the time, like, the only time I talk to trans folks is when it's a trans study, which I think is really silly.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
And so I really wanted to bring in a wide variety of experience because I'm a qualitative researcher, so I get to kind of go more in depth, but also, you know, this, what really spurred me on and realizing that, like, I just need to focus on this was because there's like a small contingent of fat folks, many of them that most people wouldn't even consider to be fat, like visually, at least, that are on TikTok that hadn't been, like, they kept going to the doctor saying something was wrong. And then it turned out that they had cancer. Their doctor kept telling them that they had, you know, that they had, they just need to lose weight, you know? And so there's this basically like medical malpractice that's happening because we don't want to create a, you know, it's more beneficial for capitalism to make money off of bariatric surgery than it is to treat fat people like they're human, you know?
Yes.
And yeah. And so, you know, it's, which on the other case, oh, hello, kitten.
This is Tonks.
Hi, Tonks.
She came over to say hi.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Very gay of us.
Bop the mic.
It's like very queer of us to bring all of our animals. I appreciate it. But yeah, I think it is. I mean, the where I really see a lot of similarities, I mean, obviously fat trans folks exist, but like where I really see like trans politics and fat politics come together really is around the body and or in medicine, you know? And I think trans folks have done, obviously it's slowly getting better, but trans folks have done a really good job of really working in the institution of medicine to make it better. And I know that that is slowly happening. But until we stop having bariatric surgeons and weight loss doctors being the authorities on fatness, we're not going to get there, you know, like it's, and that tends to be, you know, that tends to be the biggest issue, you know, often the, I don't think it was that article, but there was another one in the American Medical Association, and it was this very, well-known like Black woman. Her name's Fatima, I think, but she is a weight loss doctor, and she's like from Harvard and all of that shit. So she's got Ivy League university creds and, you know, really pulling on the I hate fat people bandwagon.
Yeah. It's for me, the issues are intersectional, as they always are. I volunteer with a, I'm on an advisory board to the city council here in Minneapolis that is focused on trans issues. But one of the things that we work on is like advising the Department of Civil Rights here on like updating the ordinances and stuff. And one of the things that we are discussing is adding body size to the protected classes within mm-hmm. the city of Minneapolis. Because it is like San Francisco did it back in like 2000. Washington, D.C. has one of those. I think Michigan is like the
whole state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the entire state has it as protected class. And it's one of those things where I'm sure you know this already, but where like when that ordinance comes out, it acts as like this education measure of people being like, oh, I've been discriminated against, rather than a lot of fat people have just accepted it. In 2018, I went to my doctor and said, I'm not sleeping well. I'm not getting enough sleep. Like, I don't feel rested when I wake up, even if I've slept like 10 hours. I need to get a sleep study done. And she was like, why don't we just try to continue with your diet or an exercise plan and like see where things go? 4 years later, I finally got a sleep study last week. Like,
yeah.
And that was with a different doctor. And now I probably have sleep apnea because guess what? It runs in my family. So,
Also, like, I was diagnosed with mild sleep apnea. So I stopped wearing my CPAP because I realized it wasn't actually helping me because it's so mild. But my pulmonologist was pushing me towards losing weight. And the study that was about that, about weight and the link between that and sleep apnea was fucking retracted. It is like not, you know, and I was like telling my pulmonologist this, who literally just retired. Like, dude should have been like reading up on this instead of just like fat shaming me every time I saw him. But yeah, Michigan is very interesting in that they added weight and height. And so I think that that was good. I know Marilyn Wan used to talk about that it was, and someone asked me if I knew the actual history. I tried to find it. It's been very hard, but the story that I heard was that there was a man that wanted to join, become a firefighter, but he was too short.
Interesting.
And so because of that, he sued for discrimination, but they couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't a protected class. So they added that to the Elliott Larson Act, which is the state law for Michigan. But I think that that is, you know, for me, the way that I think about laws is that it's a Band-Aid. Like, it's not going to fix everything. It's not going to make, I mean, as we've seen, we're still in a shit show right now, but it at least allows it so that the people that are tasked to enforce those laws, which aren't cops, are actually able to do the work to get them to, you know, to make sure that people know. Because that's, you know, I've never had to file a discrimination complaint for my weight, but since I came out as having a disability, I've had to file many, and it's great because I can just file with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights and they send an investigator out and they teach people how to follow the law, you know, and they've made one of my landlords take a class. Like, it was great, you know, just how to be annoying is to make people get educated.
And like, if it turns out to be a systemic problem within the department, they can do things like consent decrees and stuff to make sure that the entire department gets overhauled, which is happening with the Minneapolis police right now, because the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is like, you guys have been discriminating. So
And I think that it's, you know, it's always going to be a long road, but I hope that, you know, if anything, it will get people to start, you know, talking. But I think that anyone who has any type of, you know, relational anything to a city council, being able to enact that, not just on, I mean, obviously we've been updating on gender and sexuality, to include trans folks as well as, you know, queer people, you know, being able to do that, but including weight and other things as well. I mean, just making sure that we're protecting all of these different groups of people who many live at the intersection and, you know, may still, as, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw talked about the theory of intersectionality, like, you might still fall into a gap, but at least there's something there to start a conversation.
Yes.
So the last thing that I really wanted to talk about, I mean, we talked about your fat experience, but mm-hmm. I'm really interested. You just went through top surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the first things you did was like post a topless photo because you're allowed to do that now because yes. gender has freed you, you know, and I'm just wondering like what, you know, what has been your experience going from, I mean, how you experience gender, but then also like, how do people around you experience gender, you know, just really yeah. interested.
It's one of those things where I can tell, like, it helps me have that more, not necessarily androgynous, but more in between appearance. Because for the large part, people still gender me as a woman, but I've had people like correct themselves when they see me in person and like see that I mm-hmm. don't have breasts and stuff. And they're like, oh, sir. And then they do the like going back and forth thing, which is hilarious to me. And I love it. And I've had a few other experiences where it's like, now I am much more vulnerable in a lot of ways. I was in the Los Angeles airport in June, and I was using the bathroom, and a lady walked in and then walked right back out and checked the sign because she saw me standing at the sink and was like, am I in the right place? And mm-hmm. I realized that like that was a moment where like if she had wanted to, she could have started yelling, she could have like made my moment hell. Mm-hmm. And I was also like, I don't want to make her feel vulnerable about being in a space with a sort of mask presenting person. So it's changed how I interact with the world in those ways. But like on an inner life level, I'm so happy. Mm-hmm. I'm just so happy about it. My anxiety prescription has expired because I haven't mm-hmm. had to take my meds, which is so great. And it was one of those things where like about a month after surgery, I was like, my anxiety was gender dysphoria all along.
Yeah.
And it's really just been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have that like, I describe my aesthetic, my gender presentation as your dad on vacation, because I wear mm-hmm. a lot of like loud Hawaiian shirts and those sorts of button ups. And I felt more myself in my own body. Mm-hmm. And it has helped me to embrace my fatness in a way that I didn't really have before.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have gone onto a beach in a swimsuit like I did in June before I got surgery, because I felt bad and weird about my body as yeah. it was. And it helped me see myself as being in my home now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this idea of a home as a body, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, because I have PTSD, I really think of my home as like an actual place. I mean, it's mm-hmm. where I live, but it was, yeah. you know, I felt like I very much get that in, you know, it is your body. It's being able to control, you know, have autonomy over mm-hmm. who you are and how you feel. You know, although I will say having, you know, chronic pain, that is mm-hmm. a very rude place to be half yeah. the time. But, you know, I think it is. It is really just finding out like what makes you, you know, the happiest person you can be mm-hmm. and how does that work? And if that means top surgery for some, top and bottom yeah. surgery for others, no surgery at all, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm like, I feel like I like to say that I'm like a business femme, which is mm-hmm. really funny in that a lot of the reasons that I like businessy clothes is because of my dad. It's not like it's and it's because, yeah. you know, when I was, because he didn't really perform masculinity. I mean, he was a fat dude, but also he didn't perform it in a way that, you know, that's normal now. But like mm-hmm. he was born in 1940. He was, when mm. I was born, he was an engineer of a Japanese engineering company. And, you know, he learned about how to be a businessman from like Japanese men, which meant
oh, interesting.
He he would go, we could take me to the barber and he'd get his hair cut and his nails done. And like, mm-hmm. you know, by the time he died, he was like a motorcycle in Santa, like, you know, very different thing. But even yeah. again, these very two different understandings of masculinity mm-hmm. that he was able to exist in. And I love business clothes. And it was because like, he would like, it was, it's like dress up. It is, it's mm-hmm. playing dress up. And so I yeah. like that femininity in that way, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that that's what's fun. You know, I did want to mention that you were on Eugene Young, right? Young?
Yang.
Yep. Yang. There we go. Yep. I was like, I saw the Y and the G yes. and was lost in the yep. middle. For the Try Guys, you were yes. on, Casey was on it. Yeah. Close. I have such a huge crush on Eugene, but I really enjoyed that all of you were dressed so incredibly similar.
Yeah, we also like, there was blue hair and then pink and green and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, once you know a lot of non-binary folks, you know that everyone doesn't dress that way, but it was yep. really adorable that all of you were wearing, I know the video, I think you posted it on your Twitter, it's mm-hmm. obviously on the Try Guys YouTube page as yep. well, but like, it was really great. I also really appreciated that they had, you know, fat non-binary yeah. folks on there, Casey and you both, mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, I think that there are so many different ways to exist, and non-binary yeah. is this in between, you know, mm-hmm. it is, and I really think it is between, you know, if we could expand it, I mean, I really think that in between is like, at the ends of it is hegemonic masculinity yeah. and hegemonic femininity, and then it's like everything in the middle. Yep. Yeah. Ooh, I keep thinking of things that I want to talk to you about real quick. Okay, this is the last one. So you were talking about femininity and your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, because I think about this a lot, that Midwestern femininity,
oh,
yeah. femininity is so different. You know, we mm-hmm. think about it. There's an academic whose name I can't remember that would made a joke about how she plays the game of lesbian or Midwestern lady, because it is like, yeah. there is this very, you know, again, if we're thinking of hegemonic femininity, we're thinking of femininity that we see in Hollywood, you know, mm-hmm. that is very different from rural femininity. That is very different from Midwestern femininity. Mm-hmm. I mean, rural areas are Midwestern too. But it is, you know, I very much like connected with the short haircut, mm-hmm. you know, jeans and t-shirt type of femininity. And I think that is a really something that I think would be fun to end with, because we're both Midwesterners in very different places. But yeah.
Yeah. My mom was not quote unquote feminine, but she was Midwestern feminine. And that mm-hmm. is absolutely a thing, where it is practical clothing. Very often, so you wear makeup occasionally. My mom liked perfume. That was like the one feminine thing that she would do. And stuff. But like, otherwise, you're in a jeans and t-shirt, and you try to look put together, but you might like also look like you're about to go bale some hay or something like that. It is a very different, like, and it speaks to how gender is constructed in different yeah. areas and different cultures and stuff. And I think that's part of why I like being in the Midwest, because I'm in Minneapolis. I am in one of the more liberal and progressive cities in the Midwest, but it's mm-hmm. still Midwest. And Midwestern people tend to have a very practical outlook on things like how you dress and how you present yourself and how you talk. That is kind of refreshing in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, for folks that, you know, maybe are not at the point where they're ready to find that in between, they can kind of see that, you know, I think a lot of the conversations that I have, particularly in fat liberation spaces, because we see a lot of high femme, you know, high mm-hmm. femininity, very, very hyper feminized ideas of what of what femininity or womanhood or whatever mm-hmm. you want to refer to it as, that it really starts feeling like that is the expectation of mm-hmm. of everyone. Like I really would like someone to like do my like contour my face for me one day, but it would mm-hmm. be for like a day, and it's just yeah. because I want to see how much they can transform my face to not look like me. Like it is that trollish side, as you talked yes. about, that makes me feel like maybe I am a little bit more non-binary. Mm-hmm. But you know, it is, I mean, it is you know, gender for me is always, and really like the body and everything else is really mm-hmm. teaching us that us as ourself is not enough, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, flipping the script and saying maybe the way that you're feeling as not enough is really that mm-hmm. the oppression talking yes. and the unfair expectations on people, because like mm-hmm. it's fucking cold here. I don't have time. I don't want to wear heels. Heels hurt. I would mm-hmm. rather wear Doc Martens. They look cute. I put little like ribbon laces in them. That is feminine mm-hmm. enough for me, you know?
Yeah.
I like wearing skirts. I don't wear pants because they fucking hurt, but I wear yoga mm-hmm. pants most of the time. Like it is mm-hmm. this Midwestern femininity is really about comfortability and like, what can I wear? You know, I'm currently refinishing some furniture on my porch, so I'm not wearing, you know, shirts yeah. that I don't want to get stain on, you know?
It just makes me think in the winter, like if you can properly gender somebody at a distance in the winter, they are not dressed for winter.
Yes.
Like that's part of the Midwestern thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you might be able to tell I have a skirt on, but it is mm-hmm. like under layers of leggings, you know, I double yeah. up on them. And then my, you know, there are no winter coats that are warm enough for this, yeah. you know? But yeah, thank you so much. This is a little bit longer, but I'm so excited to finally get to talk to you. We've been friends on Twitter for a very long time, also Facebook, you know. Yes, I mean, I remember when you were moving all the way to Oxford. This was mm-hmm. before that wizard person yes. was, we knew that they were terrible. So you got to have your Oxford experience and feel mm-hmm. like you were in that wizarding world for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been great. I'm so excited to see your amazing career. I can't wait to see what you read next. I feel like you're gonna retire with like 40 books under your belt, and you know,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, we'll just gotta keep. Yeah, but I, you know, I think that it'll be great to see. And I do, you know, for folks that are listening, if you haven't picked this up, I really recommend it. You know, as you said, it was a 2.0 version theory wise, but I think that it was pretty accessible. I mean, you did a really good job of, you know, explaining things. So I think for folks that are not into theory should do a pretty good job of it. So yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We got, you got to see all my pets. They all yes. came, well, except for Clover. He yeah. sleeps in the basement in the summer. I don't see him. He has his like teenage bedroom down there. He's like my son. I never see him. Yeah. And so for everyone else, next month, September, which is only a week away, we are not having an episode because I was on Fat Girl Book Club. You can find that podcast. We read the book Fat Talk Nation. That should be released on September 1st on your favorite podcast app. But then in October, we are going to be talking with the author of the book Belly of the Beast. I am really, really excited about that. I'm also really excited because I want to talk to them about Black masculinities and Black fat masculinity specifically. And so, yeah, so that should be the second Friday of October. As always, it'll be live and then it'll be the next week after that. But if you want to email me questions, concerns, or you want to troll me, you can do that at fattheorybookclub@gmail.com. And I'll talk to you all later. Bye-bye.